It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, this weekend marked the 400th anniversary of the death of William Shakespeare. We'll take your calls on whether you love the Bard and his plays until the end of your days, or if you think he's, I don't know, a little bit overrated.
First, the campaigns of Senator Ted Cruz and Ohio Governor John Kasich released written statements last night about working together to stop businessman Donald Trump from getting the Republican presidential nomination. The statements detailed a plan in which Kasich stops campaigning in Indiana to clear the way for Cruz, and Cruz in turn would stop competing in New Mexico in order to make way for Kasich in those states. They called on third-party groups to follow suit.
Tim Alberta is with us now to talk about the news. He's chief political correspondent for the National Review. Tim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure, my pleasure.
Well, Tim, can you talk us through this arrangement? How far are they cooperating? How far are they not cooperating?
Well, the arrangement, you know, this is a little bit like evaluating a trade in Major League Baseball or in the NBA, right? You look at what both sides got, and in this case, the Cruz campaign had to give up something in order to get a clear path in Indiana. So they give up New Mexico and they give up Oregon. But guys, really, you look at this, and this is all about Indiana. I mean, honestly, this is, the Oregon and New Mexico parts of this equation are almost entirely meaningless because those are two states where the delegates are awarded or allocated proportionally based on the statewide vote. So you're not going to have, even if Ted Cruz finishes with 15% of the vote, he's still going to win some delegates there. Indiana, on the other hand, awards its delegates very aggressively, winner-take-all statewide and then winner-take-all by congressional districts. So Kasich pulling out of Indiana is a concession, A, that he can't win in that state, that he can't really compete for many delegates in that state, because if he could, there's no way he'd be pulling out. And B, it's an acknowledgement that if Donald Trump wins Indiana, or if he walks away with the vast majority of delegates from Indiana, that he could very well be unstoppable moving forward. So, you know, the Cruz campaign allowed the Kasich folks to kind of save face by giving them Oregon and New Mexico as kind of a small, you know, wink and a nod consolation prize. But really, this all boils down to Indiana.
Let's look at the state of play in Indiana. Last I've heard, it was pretty close between Cruz and Trump there. What are you seeing?
Well, there's been very little public polling up until recently, but what we've seen in internal polling that we've obtained in our reporting over the last 3 or 4 weeks has been pretty consistent, and that is Trump in the low to mid-30s and Cruz in sort of the high 20s to low 30s. So actually, it's very similar, the dynamic in Indiana, to what it was in Wisconsin, in your home state, about a month ago, where you looked a week and a half, 2 weeks out from the election in Wisconsin, and Cruz was, you know, anywhere from 5 to 12 points behind Donald Trump. And that was really before the full pro-Cruz and anti-Trump efforts kind of took root in the state with, you know, dozens of paid volunteers, millions of dollars of anti-Trump ads blanketing the airwaves, the full Cruz ground game, both paid and unpaid, and campaign and super PAC. So what we're seeing now in Indiana is actually pretty closely tracking with what we saw in Wisconsin. And, of course, those two states are not terribly dissimilar, especially in terms of the makeup of the Republican voting universes. So I think the sort of playbook, the blueprint that the Cruz folks used in Wisconsin was very effective. They're hoping they can reapply it in Indiana. And really, you know, where those two candidates are at this point out from Indiana and where they were at this point out from Wisconsin is eerily similar. So the Cruz people are kind of clinging to that at the moment.
Our Republican governor here in Wisconsin, by the time our primaries happened, had very enthusiastically supported Ted Cruz against Donald Trump. Anything like that going on in Indiana?
Well, so far, no. And that is much to the chagrin of the Cruz campaign. So actually, the governor of Indiana, Mike Pence, had a sit down with Donald Trump, and that was sort of a nod to, you know, some of the Tea Party folks in the state or some of the very, you know, fervent pro-Trump Republicans in the state of Indiana. Mike Pence is up for re-election this year, and he is not as popular as one would think a sitting Republican governor would be in a red state like Indiana. He's got a little bit of a challenge on his hands, and he is expected to win re-election in the fall, but he needs those, you know, Trump supporters to show up for him in November. So he's really gone out of his way to kind of tiptoe around the Trump issue. What's interesting is that people who were close to Pence, who, of course, for a long time was a congressman here in Washington, D.C., and folks who know him well say that he can't stand Trump, that he kind of abhors everything that Trump stands for, but that he is not going to kind of stick his neck out on the line and endorse Cruz the way that Scott Walker did. So that's kind of an interesting, you know, for all the talk of the parallels between the two states, that is certainly one area where there appears to be a break. Ted Cruz did have a private sit-down with Mike Pence last week. He also has had phone calls with him prior to that, but it does not look like, as of now anyway, that Governor Pence is going to change his mind and go out and endorse Cruz.
Talking to Tim Alberta from the National Review about a deal, agreement, a coordination effort released this weekend. Candidates John Kasich, Ted Cruz saying, hey, I'll focus here, you focus there. Hopefully we'll keep Donald Trump, they're thinking, from winning enough delegates. Well, is this thing going to work, Tim? Could enough people be swayed, I guess, from the Kasich camp to the Cruz camp to overcome that slight deficit he has behind Donald Trump?
Well, it could work, you know, and if it doesn't, I think there's going to be a lot of second guessing about why it took so long for this to take place. Because, it, you know, keep in mind, it's not just the month's worth of contests that are in the rearview mirror, but how about tomorrow? I mean, you have five elections tomorrow in the Northeast, and had Cruz and Kasich come to this kind of agreement a week ago or 2 weeks ago, I think it's very possible that they could have, you know, taken from Donald Trump an additional, say, 20 to 25 delegates tomorrow, and that could make all the difference. So it's very interesting that it took this long, and I think, again, the Cruz folks and the Kasich folks, despite their many differences, despite their rivalry throughout this campaign, despite some, you know, some sniping back and forth, I think they, you know, both camps can now see the math pretty plainly here, and they realize that if Indiana gets away from them both, then really it doesn't matter what happens moving forward, because Donald Trump is going to be in a very good position to hit the magic number he needs to win the nomination. So it can work, and they had better hope it does work, because if it doesn't, they're going to be facing a whole lot of backlash from Republicans who are going to wonder, you know, why ego and pride seemingly got in the way of reaching this kind of arrangement, you know, several weeks prior.
Well, we saw something like this when Marco Rubio said, hey, let's do this to John Kasich. You take Ohio, I'll take Florida. We won't try to compete. John Kasich didn't seem to want to have anything to do with that. And whatever happened, it didn't seem to help Marco Rubio any. So maybe that's the example. People thought it just wasn't going to work.
Yeah, you know, and it's interesting, of course, Kasich did win Ohio and by a bigger margin than anyone could have expected. But yeah, it didn't do much, you know. Kasich didn't really help Rubio any in Florida. And, you know, I do think it's interesting when you study Indiana. You know, the key, I think, to winning Wisconsin for Cruz, despite everything else that was discussed and analyzed in the aftermath of the victory there on April the 5th, you know, if you look at Kasich's underperformance in the wild counties there around Milwaukee, I think that was really the most critical aspect of Cruz's statewide victory, because if Kasich even hits respectable numbers, 25%, say, of the vote in those three suburban Milwaukee counties, then Cruz suddenly might be in trouble statewide. He probably still wins, but by a very, 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 very narrow margin. And that was the anticipation, that was the expectation, really, around all the different campaigns. The Cruz folks, up until primary day, were fearful, and they were dropping hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of anti-Kasich mailers in the Milwaukee suburbs, fearful that Kasich could peel away a significant chunk of those, you know, affluent, upper-middle-class, white-collar voters. And instead, Kasich underperformed so badly there that Cruz wound up running away with the state. So I think that what we're seeing now, this arrangement between those two campaigns, could be very significant in the Indianapolis suburbs and then up in, you know, northwest Indiana in the Chicago suburbs, which are home to a lot of those same kinds of voters. And that's where Kasich would have naturally pulled very strongly. If Kasich can go from, you know, 25 or 30% in those areas where he is right now, all the way down to, you know, 15% or so where he wound up in those Milwaukee suburbs, then I think Cruz is probably in pretty good shape in Indiana. But, you know, those two states, for all their similarities, again, there's absolutely no guarantee that one is going to shake out the same as the other.
Now, here's a weird thing. We haven't talked directly about Donald Trump. Us being in 2016, we always seem to. So let's give a listen to his reaction to this deal. He's at a rally in Rhode Island here.
And actually, I was happy because it shows how weak they are. It shows how pathetic they are.
So Trump's play here is to try to get to that 1,237 magic number of delegates coming into the competition. What does he need to do to avoid the divide and conquer strategy here?
Well, you know, I think that he's going to do very well tomorrow in these five northeastern states, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, where he obviously was speaking there, Delaware and Connecticut and Maryland as well. I think that, you know, of the 118 bound delegates that are up for grabs tomorrow, I think you probably see Trump win, you know, upwards of 90 of them, maybe even upwards of 100 of them. So he's going to do well tomorrow. I think the question moving forward is how much money does he want to spend in the state of Indiana? Again, everybody can see the math here. Everybody can see the writing on the wall. It's not just the Cruz and the Kasich folks. The Trump people are very much aware that if they can somehow pull off a statewide win in Indiana, they would get those 30 delegates statewide. And then if they can even win, you know, five or six of the congressional districts, then they get, you know, another 15 or 18 delegates. If they walk away from Indiana with nearly 50 delegates, this might be game over. So it'll be very interesting to see, you know, on the one hand, as I said at the outset, the Cruz and Kasich strategy here is all about Indiana. And I think Trump and his folks are going to be smart enough to realize that. So do they counter it by going totally all in on Indiana? Did they decide to pump, you know, $5 or $6 million worth of spending on the airwaves into the state? That's a decision that I think they're going to have to make pretty quickly, and that's going to be one of the biggest tactical questions here that remains unanswered of the entire primary season.
Tim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks, guys.
That's Tim Alberta, chief political correspondent for the National Review. Join us to talk about the agreement between Senator Ted Cruz and Governor John Kasich to work together in an attempt to deny Donald Trump the Republican presidential nomination. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, our guest looks at the causes of racial segregation in the United States and why it's lasted so long.
First, this weekend marked the 400th anniversary of the death of William Shakespeare. The weekend was marked by celebrations in Stratford-upon-Avon, the English birthplace of Shakespeare, where his plays are still performed to this day by the Royal Shakespeare Company.
By the end of his life, Shakespeare had written 38 plays and more than 150 sonnets, and the works of the bard are still considered required reading for students around the world.
And on this anniversary, we want to hear from you. Are you a Shakespeare fan or not? Call 800-642-1234. There are a lot of people who are very specifically opposed to. They dislike Shakespeare, it turns out.
And some of those people have come out of hiding thanks to Ira Glass, who's been very vocal about his feelings about Shakespeare. They're not positive. We interviewed him on Central Time a while back. For some reason, we talked about Hamlet. Here he is.
The plot of Hamlet, I don't think, could be on an episode of This American Life because there's no one to relate to. Like, they're not good enough for our show. No, I mean, I say that, I'm being facetious, but you know what I mean? Like they're not right for our show, because I feel like we're looking for stories that are more emotional than either of those stories.
So what do you think? Are you a Shakespeare fan or a hater? If you don't like him, what keeps you from loving the bard? If he's changed your life, how has he done that? What do you think? Is it okay not to like Shakespeare?
Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. Go right to our callers with Layla in Madison. Layla, hi.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
What do you think, Layla?
I absolutely love Shakespeare and his works. I've actually performed in 8 of his full-length productions with the Young Shakespeare Players here in Madison.
Well, what were some of your favorite productions to be in and favorite roles to play?
Well, my favorite role was Juliet in Romeo and Juliet. And one of my other favorite plays is Winter's Tale, and I played Hermione in that one.
And so you're obviously a young person in these plays. Shakespeare, you know, 400-year-old material here. You felt like it spoke to you?
Yes, I did.
All right. Well,
Definitely. Layla,
thank you so much for sharing that. The great, great way to start as somebody who's actually not just read or watched, but been in a bunch of Shakespeare plays.
Right. And we want to hear from you on this. Are you with Layla? Do you feel like the bard speaks to you, or when he speaks, do you just not get it? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And we go next to Jerry in Glendale. Jerry, hi.
I have two reasons why I love Shakespeare. A, he was a Catholic in a time of persecution of Catholics in England. And B, he was the son of a glove maker, a kid from the working class. And all of these Shakespeare deniers, I don't care who they are. The biggest one in this country was Mark Twain. They hate him because he came from the working class. And he wrote these brilliant plays as if somebody from the working class, say from the north side of Milwaukee, couldn't write beautiful poetry. And that's a prejudice against society writ large. They just don't want to see someone like that succeed. And Shakespeare succeeded brilliantly.
Well, Jerry, thank you so much for that very passionate defense of Shakespeare right there. And Jerry's saying he's from the working class.
All right. Thanks a lot for that call, Jerry, at 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Alan in Viroqua. Alan, hi.
Howdy. How y'all doing?
Good. What do you think?
For me, Shakespeare, I really never enjoyed reading it, but I really do enjoy watching it and listening to it being performed. I like to go to American Players Theater and go to those Shakespeare plays, and really that's all I got to say.
Well, it makes a lot of sense, though, doesn't it? I mean, because it was written not to be, you know, read by somebody sitting on a couch. It was written for the people to see it and hear it. I guess Alan's gone. Yeah, but I mean, that there's something. I've read Shakespeare plays. It's okay. But yeah, there's something like special going
right.
to APT or somewhere
the
and actually hearing it.
It's
yeah.
pretty transformative when you see it on the stage. But I like reading Shakespeare sonnets. That's something which, you know, doesn't need to be read aloud. They're beautiful.
Probably more fun to read it out loud, even to yourself, though, I imagine. Well, let's hear a little bit out loud, actually. A lot of famous people have done Shakespeare. Here's David Tennant, you know, Doctor Who, Judi Dench, you know, awesome. They appeared on stage this weekend to celebrate Shakespeare, and this performance of Hamlet had a special guest star recite the play's most famous line. Let's give a listen.
Just a minute. To be or not to be, that is the question.
Well, our question is, who was that? Well, that was Prince Charles, actually. He'd earlier been in the audience. I guess he, I don't know if he used some kind of royal prerogative to deliver a Shakespeare line or if it was all arranged and everybody was in on the bit there.
He did okay with that one line anyway.
If this whole royalty career doesn't work out for him, he can try acting.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Are you a Shakespeare denialist, as Jerry called him, or a Shakespeare lover? Tom is with us next in Milwaukee. Tom, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Good. I love Shakespeare, and particularly I like his comedy, like Twelfth Night or Midsummer Night's Dream are just delightful plays, and I've seen them, but I really enjoy reading them, too.
Oh, so you like all aspects of taking in Shakespeare. Tom, I appreciate that. Loves the comedies. I like the comedies, too. It's hard to, you know, it's hard to pick a favorite, but the comedies always get you.
As a history nerd, I like the histories, even if they're not always dead on with the historical accuracy. You know, a lot of people have done different versions of Shakespeare, updated theatrical performances and movies. And let's not forget the sonnets. Here's singer Rufus Wainwright performing Shakespeare's Sonnet 29.
When in disgrace with fortune in men's eyes, I'll alone beweep my outcast state, and trouble deaf heaven with my bootless cries.
Let's go back to our callers. That's Rufus Wainwright doing a Shakespeare sonnet to Gail next with us in Milwaukee. Gail, hi.
Hi. I just recently watched Hamlet for the very first time because of all of the hoopla that I heard on the BBC, and I thought that I wanted to find out what it was about. I was apprehensive because I thought it would be too complicated or I wouldn't understand the language, and I didn't find that to be true. And I also found it very contemporary, not a lot different than like 48 Hours or something. I really enjoyed it.
Well, Gail, who was the Hamlet that you saw?
Who was the Hamlet? Well, I watched one first that was apparently too contemporary, and I don't know who it was. And then I watched another one with the guy that was that plays Doctor Who. What's his name?
Yeah, I was wondering. I saw that one, too. It was Benedict Cumberbatch as Hamlet from the
Sherlock,
who was doing it live at the National Theatre, the Royal Theatre in London. And he was a pretty good Hamlet, I thought, too.
The first one I saw was post-World War II, and I thought it was London, but apparently it was Denmark or something. I don't know, but my brother knows Shakespeare Latin. He said they took a lot of liberties with that particular showing, so then I looked up, like, the real, what are they called, the Royal Shakespeare performance.
Okay, so you've really dabbled a lot in you sampled a lot of Hamlet. It's good for you, Gail.
Thanks a lot, Gail, for calling in. Still time to share your thoughts. No haters out there in Wisconsin, I guess. Everybody, what we've learned here, 100% love for Shakespeare
Wisconsin
in the great state of Wisconsin.
Love Shakespeare.
We know this now. But you could tell us different over at the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up after the news, a look at the persistence of segregation in many cities and suburbs in the United States. Our guest says it didn't just happen by accident. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll find out about a new suite of bills just signed into law that are designed to prevent child abuse in Wisconsin.
First, despite court-ordered desegregation efforts dating back six decades, many American communities and school districts remain highly segregated by race, with the Milwaukee area, by many measures, showing up as the most segregated metropolitan area in the nation.
Our next guest says many cities and suburbs are heavily segregated, and he says it didn't just happen by accident. He says there's a long list of causes of segregation, including the placement of affordable housing, the way school district lines are drawn, and different access to mortgages for people of different races.
Myron Orfield joins us now. He's a professor of law and director of the Institute on Metropolitan Opportunity at the University of Minnesota. His books include American Metropolitics, the New Suburban Reality. Myron, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get to the causes of segregation, how segregated are we, a big picture, here in the United States?
Well, I think that we have become a little less segregated. The particularly black population in the United States became more segregated from the beginning of the century, really, till the 1970s. And we've stepped back a little bit from levels where 8 or 9 out of 10 people would have to move to be integrated to more like levels of 5 or 6 people. But Milwaukee is pretty intensely and continuously segregated. So is Detroit and Chicago. The places where you have really intense racial segregation have stayed about the same at very high levels of racial segregation.
And this isn't just in cities and urban areas themselves. You've written a lot and talked a lot about suburban segregation in parts of the country.
There's a growing number of non-white suburbs that are some of the poorest places in metropolitan America. There are dozens of suburbs on the south side of Chicago that are overwhelmingly non-white and poor and have low tax base. Ferguson, Missouri is an example of such a place we've heard about recently. That's an increasing trend, is a lot of the problems that have hit central cities are now really present in the suburbs and growing in certain suburbs.
The civil rights movement in the last century, courts in the last century, definitely spelled out, pointed out a value of integration, maybe an idea that there's damage done when we're segregated. But maybe as a nation as a whole, we haven't embraced that yet. What is the value of more integration?
Well, kids of all races that go to integrated schools feel more comfortable living and working together in an integrated society, in an integrated marketplace, in living in integrated neighborhoods. And that's particularly important for non-white kids who often have trouble navigating a world that is where a lot of the power structures are dominated by white people. And if they have some contact with white people and the way that the white society works, it helps. It also helps white people become acquainted and deal with a growingly diverse United States. Racial integration has undeniable benefits for low-income kids of color in terms of it improves their likelihood of graduating from high school, of going to college or some form of higher education, of finding a job with middle-income wages. So those are pretty clear benefits. Test scores, I think the consensus of academic opinion are that racially and socially integrated schools improve test scores, too.
I think sometimes there's a sense that, well, we just sort of sorted ourselves out by individual decisions, maybe by accident, and here we are segregated. You say, no, there are a lot of policies, business decisions, things like that, that have created our current pockets of segregation. What goes into that?
Well, I think that there's a lot of things, at least six or so things, some what people would call private discrimination, some governmental discrimination. But as black families and Latino families move to the suburbs, where more than half of them live now, and almost three-quarters of black and Latino married families with children that are middle class, they're often, as they move to the suburbs, they're often shown different parts of the suburbs than whites with similar education, income, and credit histories. They're often steered to parts of the suburbs where the schools are racially diverse, and whites of similar income, education, and credit histories are steered toward much whiter parts of the suburbs. A black family or black household that earns $157,000 a year is less likely to qualify for a prime loan than a white household that earns $40,000 a year. And qualifying for a prime loan gives you a lot more choices. It allows you to stretch your income, which a lot of families do when they're trying to find the best school district for their kids.
And Myron, I want to get into some of the other six causes, but I want to put a pin in that one right now. You just said a black family that earns four times as much as a comparable white family can't get as good a loan.
Are less likely.
Less likely.
Look at the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act statistics than a white family, right?
What's happening there? Why is that happening?
Well, I think that one of the things that people say in response is that black families are systematically less creditworthy than white families are. So a black family that earns $157,000 a year is systematically less creditworthy than a white family that earns $40,000 a year, but there's no real evidence that that's true. A lot of times when banks are faced with these kinds of numbers, they say that the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act doesn't have access to the credit histories of people, but these credit histories are private, so scholars like me can't look at them. We can't even understand how the credit histories are calculated because the algorithms that they use to calculate the credit histories are proprietary. But in the instances where banks and others have allowed the credit histories to be compared to the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act data, they found that they explained some of the difference, but not nearly a large percentage of that huge difference in approval.
Talking to Myron Orfield, professor of law at the University of Minnesota, about why segregation persists in the United States. Myron, you mentioned schools that realtors, others might be steering white families to one district, diverse families to other districts.
Yeah.
You've also talked about how a school district lines and boundaries are drawn. How does that play into segregation?
Well, often when a suburb is beginning to become diverse, there'll be a triggering event so that the population perhaps of the district will decline, or the population on one side of the district, the wider district, will increase, and a new school will be opened or an old school will be closed. And these are chances that the school district can redraw the boundaries, either to make the schools integrated, to preserve the segregation of the neighborhoods, or to make the neighborhoods or to make the schools more segregated than the neighborhoods. And often the school districts draw boundaries that either preserve the segregation of the neighborhood or make the neighborhood schools more segregated, make the schools more segregated than the neighborhoods are. And that's a fairly common pattern when school districts have one of these triggering events. So in a racially diverse suburb, you often see boundaries drawn in a way that intensifies the segregation of the neighborhood.
We see gerrymandered school districts. How? Why?
Well, I think that everybody wants to be in the best school, and the best school is the one with the smallest percentage of poor kids, and the ones that have the smallest percentage of poor kids in places like Milwaukee and Minneapolis tend to be the whitest school districts. So there's a lot of things that go into this, but there's a tremendous lobbying force for everybody to want to be drawn into that boundary of the best schools. And usually the people that are able to get drawn into the boundary of those best schools are the whitest, most affluent members of the district.
Another cause of segregation that you've talked about a lot in the past is affordable housing. And I think you use even a different phrase like that. You say the way government policies, private decisions cite affordable housing does a lot to maintain segregation.
Yeah.
How does that happen?
Well, in most places of the country, in the late 70s and 80s, when they were studying the effects of housing on school desegregation, they found that if the HUD subsidized housing had been placed differently, there would be no need for desegregation orders of any kind. And that continues to the present day. Even though we have pretty good civil rights laws, we continue to build an overwhelming percentage of low-income affordable housing in the poorest and most segregated neighborhoods with the poorest and most segregated schools. And this is a lost opportunity. There are places in the country that have a history of trying to build in wider suburban communities, and there is the ability to do that, but often the agencies that fund these programs create criteria that overwhelmingly destine these units to go in the poorest neighborhoods.
A lot of these have something in common. Is it that white affluent groups are lobbying to, as you say, get those school lines drawn to determine where affordable housing gets placed so that it doesn't come in near them? Is this part of the problem in a lot of these causes?
I think, most communities, middle-income communities, to the extent they're aware of it, they don't want to have a government-subsidized housing located in their communities. So there's opposition, and there's much less opposition in poor neighborhoods about this. I think there's also, on the other side, there are also a number of developers that think it's just easier to build in these poor neighborhoods. They don't have opposition, and sometimes they can get state and federal funds, which are available in the suburbs, but they can also get foundation money and bank reinvestment money, and they can get the cities to put extra money on the table so that the units can be much more profitable for these developers to build and much less of a hassle because they're not opposed. So there are not that many places where you have white suburbs that are willing to build affordable housing, but often in those places where you have some willingness, you have an industry that likes to build affordable housing in very poor neighborhoods because it's easier and more profitable.
We're talking to Myron Orfield about segregation in American cities and suburbs. He says it's still around, especially prevalent in some pockets of the country, like the Milwaukee metropolitan area. And he says it's no accident. There are policies on things like school districts and affordable housing, decisions by mortgage lenders and others that keep segregation around in many American communities.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you see this going on in your community? And what could be done to integrate neighborhoods and schools in Wisconsin? Should affordable housing be located in a wider variety of neighborhoods? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we continue our conversation with law professor Myron Orfield at the University of Minnesota, looking at why schools and neighborhoods are still segregated in American cities and suburbs.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see this kind of racial segregation in your community? What do you think causes it? What could change it? If you're a member of a minority community, have you ever been steered toward housing in one neighborhood or another? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Myron, looking at the list of causes here, I mean, you've got a lot of actors, the federal government, the local school districts, developers, individual discrimination at a lot of levels. Does this make it hard for somebody to take ownership of this problem and try to tackle it?
It makes it very hard because I think that any one particular actor can say that their actions are strongly influenced by the other actors. So if the real estate agents say they're accused of steering, they'll say, well, the banks won't approve loans for black people in these high-income neighborhoods. And, when steering occurs and property values begin to decline, when white people begin to be steered away from racially diverse neighborhoods and property values decline, banks can say, well, the property values are declining here, so we have to tighten up credit. When the school district decides to draw a really racially segregated boundary, then suddenly the real estate agents will say that school has gotten a lot lower test scores and we are not going to, show people that area. So, I mean, it's all intertwined in very complicated ways. And that's why it's sometimes hard to think about these things or to challenge them or to fix them. You can fix one of the six or seven things and the other five will persist.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Rich is with us in Two Rivers. Rich, hi.
Yeah, hi. How are you guys doing?
Good. What do you think?
This is what I think. I've been asking you guys to put this on air, this same subject, for between Joy and some of your other people, and I've been sending them text messages. It's a very controversial subject, and I don't have an opinion on it because I live in Two Rivers, Wisconsin, and there is a social element that that's a big welfare town. But I just spent the week before last with a friend that has a lot of money. I mean, he's up there with Trump, and he ended up buying a farmland just outside Minneapolis, and where he bought his land, and he bought it because he has one daughter and he wanted her to go to that school district. Well, right down right about 2 miles from his, in the same district, they just built a 400 unit family housing with a bus depot terminal that people can go and try to find jobs and do what they can do. And I believe in social development. I'm not arguing with it. I'm not arguing with anything. So I heard his whole opinion on the matter. And then I went to my other friend's house when I was going back home to Two Rivers in Hudson. And she's far left, far left. And I asked her opinion on it. And she said she moved to where she moved. So and she's from a wealthy family. So her children would have that influence.
All right, Rich, I think I get where you're going there. So this kind of idea, building affordable housing in a wealthier area, Myron, what do you make of that?
Yeah, I think the Twin Cities tries to do this, it ebbs and flows, and generally we have pretty good results for the kids when they get a chance to live in neighborhoods where they have good schools. You see the low-income kids' test scores improve, their likelihood of graduating improves, their likelihood to go to college goes up, but it is really controversial, but it makes a difference.
Rich, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Laura in Milwaukee. Laura, hi.
Hi. When we bought our house here in 1979, they tried to steer us farther into inner city of Milwaukee. We built our house out here. We're a mixed-race family. They really tried to dissuade us from building here. And we were adamant to build our house out here off of Granville Road.
Laura, thanks a lot for sharing that. And Laura's is a common story, Myron. Probably a lot of couples, minority families, mixed-race families like Laura's probably encountered the same opposition.
Yeah, I think you could talk to virtually any black middle-class or upper-income family and ask them what their experience has been in trying to buy a house in a white neighborhood, and I think you'd hear a similar story. It's very common.
Laura, thanks for your call. We're talking to Myron Orfield, law professor at the University of Minnesota, looking at the persistence of segregation in many parts of the United States, cities and suburbs. Many, but not all, Myron. What places have been successful in turning the tide on segregation? What's worked?
Well, there are some places in the country that are less segregated than others, and some of the places, Louisville, Kentucky is a place. Louisville and Jefferson County has reduced their segregation a lot, has integrated their schools across their metropolitan area for almost 50 years, and it's not a utopia by any means, but it looks a lot different than a place like Milwaukee or Detroit does, and they have an equally large challenge or larger challenge in terms of the rate of poverty in the region and the rate of diversity. They don't have the big, huge, distressed neighborhoods, and they don't have the kinds of achievement gaps you see in Wisconsin or Detroit.
So what did they do in a place like Louisville?
Well, they tried to create a program that encouraged all the schools in the whole metropolitan area to be integrated. And not just, a lot of times in the Midwest, in a place like Minneapolis or Milwaukee, they'll integrate just the city schools, and then everyone will just that has choices will move away. But in Louisville and Jefferson County and Wake County, North Carolina, they tried to integrate all the schools across the whole metropolitan area. And it not only had quite very positive effects for the kids, but it also made the neighborhoods more integrated and more stable.
Were people into this, though? Because we talked about the history of the busing efforts back in the 1970s, plus or minus a decade, and there was a lot of opposition from the largely white school districts in metro areas to that kind of integration on a metropolitan-wide basis. Are people getting more on board with that idea now?
Well, I think in both of those places, Louisville and Wake County, they were released from the court order after many years of being forced to integrate, and then they decided to keep it. They thought it worked pretty well. So So those were situations where two places in the country maybe were reluctant to undertake the beginnings of integration, but once they'd implemented a successful program for 20 or 30 years, when the court said you don't have to anymore, they decided, their elected officials decided that it worked. So they decided to keep it. Now, that isn't very common, but it certainly happened there. And I think partly they did a good job. Now, usually what happens in northern cities is there was a court ordered to integrate the city, and then the people that had the ability to leave left. And so there was never any stability, and there was not very much integration. It didn't last very long.
Let's bring on another caller. We have Mary on the line in Green Bay. Mary, hi.
Yeah, hi. I've been listening to your show, and I just want to say we relocated from the Southwest about 2 years ago, and we were looking for homes both in Milwaukee and Green Bay. And when we were in Milwaukee and working with the realtor, he was definitely steering us away from certain neighborhoods. And we had been living out west for a long time and hadn't experienced that before. So it was very blatant.
Based on race, Mary?
Yeah.
Mary, thanks a lot for sharing that. And Myron, this is probably happening a lot of, realtor-consumer discussions where people just talk about their friends where to buy a house. How do you get a handle on that? This is something that, isn't necessarily out there in the public eye.
No, it's hard to prove that they're steering. And the way that you do this is you do testing. So you'll get people that really understand how to conduct a test, an unbiased test, people that can do this in a fair way. And they will bring in groups of white households and black households that are matched, and they'll have the same income and credit history and educational backgrounds. They'll have pairs, maybe a dozen pairs or two dozen or even 100 pairs. And they'll be taught to ask exactly the same questions to the realtors. And what happens is then you'll see that the black families will be shown certain parts of the suburbs and white families very different parts of the suburbs. And it happens over and over and over again. It's just not very many places undertake this testing, even though it's a good idea and may even be required by the Fair Housing Act. But that's the only way you can really ferret it out, because it's subtle usually. A lot of times people don't say, you're black and you're not going to be able to live in this nice place. They just don't show them houses there. And on the other hand, white families, even if they may be interested or want to live in an integrated neighborhood, they just often don't even get the choice because the real estate agents make that decision for them.
Myron, briefly in our last half minute, is there an appetite in segregated communities to tackle this problem?
Well, I think that as you see more and more of the suburbs going through this process of becoming integrated and then poor, and you see regions of the country build more and more new rings of suburbs, and you have more and more rings of suburbs get poor, maybe people will look at places like Louisville and Wake County, which haven't had that pattern, and say maybe this is a possibility. If you look at those places which really tried to do this and really tried to work on interracial relationships, they've shown not only have they shown really big improvements in their kids' test scores, but they've shown much stronger central cities with much more stable values.
We'll leave it there. Myron Orfield, thanks for joining us. That's Myron Orfield, professor of law at the University of Minnesota, talking about continuing racial segregation in many parts of the United States. Last night, HBO dropped the new season of Game of Thrones. For folks at the Washington Post covering politics, it seems like a Game of Thrones and the presidential race are kind of starting to blur together.
So the Post got its arts and entertainment reporters to quiz its political reporters about who said it, someone from the campaign trail or a Game of Thrones character. That's the HBO show, if you're not aware. And the same exercise is now going to be put to Game of Thrones super nerd,
yes,
Rob Ferret.
Yes.
Rob, you ready?
Let's give it a shot.
All right, so who said this?
Is it campaign or Game of Thrones?
Campaign or Game of Thrones. The world is a horrible place. Lions kill for food, but people kill for sport.
That's got to be from Game of Thrones. A Lannister of some sort saying that?
Final answer?
Yeah.
Wrong.
Uh-oh.
That would be Donald Trump.
Oh!
From a book called Think Big and Kick Something I Probably Shouldn't Say on the Air. All right, next one. As I said, I was young and stupid.
Presidential campaign, John Kasich would say something off the cuff like that.
Wrong again. Oh. This is Tyrion.
Tyrion Lannister.
Tyrion Lannister,
okay.
Right. And Right. Well, enough said about that one, the better. A next quote. Every marriage is a mystery to me, even the one I'm in, so I'm no expert on it.
Donald Trump.
Wrong.
Come on.
Sorry, I'm not making this stuff up. This is from Hillary Rodham Clinton,
okay,
from
at
a
least
British
it was a
talk
candidate.
Show. Okay, finally, I will be your champion.
That's Game of Thrones. No, that's Hillary Clinton.
Oh, my gosh, Rob. No, Oberyn Martell from
and
Game of Thrones.
Hillary Clinton.
Uh-huh. All right. Not so much.
All right, back to the books for me. This is Central Time.